listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skulls in a pool of cerebral spinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. Didn't history already happen? Part 6. Today we'll look at history through the lens of skepticism and critical thinking skills, and I'll then connect the discussion to the martial arts. In particular, I'm going to discuss two different aspects of historiography, or the way history is written. The first is the way that myths sneak into the historical record disguised as fact. And the second is something called the great man hypothesis of history. First, the myths. Now, there are lots of different reasons that historians lie or exaggerate when creating their version of the written record. One of the most prevalent in recent centuries has to do with the nation-state. Nation-state is a common term used in history and politics, and it describes exactly what it sounds like: a nation, a country. Why is this word significant or important? It's counterintuitive to us in the modern world, but the idea of a nation, or of having feelings of nationalism, is actually a quite recent phenomenon. Before the last few centuries, people were much more likely to identify, say, as members of a tribe, or citizens of a town, or as belonging to a piece of land owned by a nobleman, like a duke or a count, or as adherents of a religion, than to identify as a Frenchman or a Swede. This is not to say that there was no nationalism or nation-states until recently. It's just that it was far from being as widespread as it is today. To understand this better, let's look at a people who still don't have a country of their own, the Kurds. Most of you have heard of them. They're an ethnic group of more than 30 million people that live in a region spanning parts of four different countries: Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. Doesn't that sound like a great place to have your people's homeland? Kurds are not Arabs, or Turks, or Iranians, but they do speak a language related to Farsi, the Iranian language. They are, by far, the largest ethnic group in the world that doesn't have a country of their own. As I mentioned, their homeland is awkwardly placed right smack in the middle of some of the most fought-over land on Earth. But that's nothing new for the Kurds. During the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, the Turkish Ottoman Empire and the Iranian Persian Empire fought 13 wars with each other. But guess whose homeland was right on the frontier between those two warring empires? That's right, our friends the Kurds. Their homeland was passed back and forth repeatedly between the Turks and the Persians over these centuries. Then, a century ago, the Ottoman Empire fought as an ally of Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire in World War I. As part of the peace treaty that ended that war, the Ottoman Empire was broken up, creating what would eventually become at least a dozen new nation-states, among which were Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. But no Kurdistan. Kurdish representatives were right there at the treaty negotiations, lobbying hard for a country of their own. But they were unable to win the French and the British, and those were the people that mattered, over to their cause. So the Kurds are a nation without a nation state. That was actually the case for lots of ethnicities in the past. By the mid-1800s, most of the developed world consisted of large empires rather than nation-states. They were called the Great Powers, and included Great Britain, France, Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and Russia. For the vast number of different ethnic groups within these empires, the concept and process of nationalism grew more influential in 1848, a watershed year in world history, when revolutions raged across the European continent. Now, nationalism can mean many different things to many different people, that in this case, it's the feeling that your particular group or ethnicity is special, or even chosen for a special destiny by a deity, and that at the minimum, it deserves a country of its own. After the revolutions of 1848, budding nationalism led directly to the formation, for the first time in history, to a united and independent Italy and Germany. Now, I just bet that many of you didn't know that the United States is about a century older as a country than either Germany or Italy. But the real avalanche of new countries came at the end of World War I, when the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire were removed from the world stage and broken up, giving a plethora of nationalities nation-states of their own. Now, if you were someone promoting nationalism for your particular group or shiny new nation-state, you would want to get as many of your people as possible fired up and on the nationalist bandwagon. One way to do this is through propaganda, and one of the oldest forms of propaganda is disguised as history. Historians call this form national myths. National myths insinuate their tendrils backwards along the timeline, often appropriating older people and cultures in the process. This type of retroactive myth-making resulted, for example, in both French and German nationalists laying claim in the 19th century to the ancient barbarian tribal confederation called the Franks. The Germans claimed them because they had spoken a Germanic language. The French did so because the name France was originally Francia, or Land of the Franks. But if you were to travel back in time and tell a Frankish tribesman that he was either German or French, he wouldn't have a clue what you were talking about. This sort of behavior is common, with Mexican nationalists claiming the Aztecs, Scotland claiming the ancient Picts, and so on. There are other forms of nationalist myths full of heroic exploits. France has the Song of Roland. England has King Arthur. Spain has El Cid Campeador. Russia, Poland, and the Czech Republic have the story of the three brothers, Lech, Czech, and Rus. You'd be hard-pressed to find a modern country without its national myths, especially myths about the founders of the country. Our own myths in the U.S. include George Washington and the cherry tree, most of the exploits of Daniel Boone, Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech, Betsy Ross sewing the first American flag for George Washington, and Paul Revere's ride. Every one of these stories is either a complete fabrication or includes major exaggerations to enhance the folkloric effect. And the stories did their job, too, helping to generate a feeling of historical pride among the citizens of a brand new country. That's great, but it's not history. Now, here's where I relate all of this back to the martial arts. In the martial arts, styles are like nation-states, complete with patriotism and myths, especially myths about the founder of the style. Various Filipino systems try to appropriate Lapu-Lapu, the chieftain that killed Magellan over four centuries ago, as somehow exemplifying their style. In Kung Fu, it's the legends of the exploits of the Shaolin monks, especially the five elders, who, legend has it, survived the destruction of the Shaolin Temple, and went on to found or contribute to the founding of an entire array of kung fu styles. One of them, a Buddhist nun named Ung Mui, is credited not only with creating Wing Chun Kung Fu and teaching it to a young lady named Yim Wing Chun, but also with founding four other styles of kung fu. Other bits of martial arts style myths include Masayama, the founder of Kyokushin Karate, killing a bull with his bare hands, or Gojen Yamaguchi, the founder of Gojukai Karate, doing him one better and killing a Siberian tiger with his bare hands, or famed Filipino martial arts master Floro Villabrea, supposedly being educated in the finer points of weaponry by the beautiful, blind, but invincible Filipino princess Josefina. Okay, let's move on to the other parallel between general history and martial arts history. It's the controversial great man hypothesis. That's an idea developed by historians in the 1800s. As the study of history became more formalized, historians began to ask questions about why history unfolded the way it did. What forces, if any, drove events in the human world? In the 1840s, a Scottish historian named Thomas Carlyle popularized the notion that the most important factor that influenced history was the regular appearance of highly talented, skilled, and influential people. This hypothesis asserted that great men drove history by using their abilities in a way that shaped the course of world events. Great man, however, does not necessarily mean good man. The list of great men would also include Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, as well as Buddha, Gandhi, and Martin Luther King. But then a rival hypothesis was put forth by other historians. It postulated that highly talented people are actually born frequently, but only a few become great men when the proper forces like cultural change, technological advances, and financial swings create the conditions to allow it. This means that history creates the great man more than the great man creates history. Again, I see here a parallel in the world of the martial arts. A great man hypothesis of martial arts history would assert that people like Jigoro Kano, the founder of judo, or Elio Gracie, or Bruce Lee, were themselves the most important factors in shaping the history of the martial arts in their time. But without the cultural effect of increasing globalization, intermingling ideas between the East and the West, would we still know their names? During the mid to late 1800s, the Meiji government in Japan put on an intense push to modernize industry, government, and especially education. The elite of Japan were determined to make their country a competitive player in the modern world. In the mid-1800s, Japan was a stunted, backwater nation, hidebound by tradition. But that was a century and a half ago. Look at Japan now. Jigoro Kano, the founder of judo, was born in the first generation in Japan that was growing up after this push for modernization began. One benefit that Mr. Kano gained from this effort was the combination of an Eastern and Western education that his forward-looking father insisted that he get. Considering the social caste he'd been born into, this would have been impossible in an earlier era. Before Mr. Kano came along, the Japanese martial arts were uninfluenced by Western thought. He may well have saved them from fading into obscurity or dying out altogether by drawing from Western sources to modernize training practices and develop a sport that could more safely be used for physical education in modern Japanese schools. But did this happen because Mr. Kano was unique in his genius? Or is it that people with such traits are born fairly regularly through the course of time? And he happened to be the one born into the right place at the right time. I think this is also probably the case for other pivotal great men or women in the martial arts as well. Well, this wraps up my series on the importance of learning history and of applying critical thinking skills to what you learn from it. I think that both training in the martial arts and developing critical thinking skills nurture skill sets that are extremely helpful in dealing with the challenges of being a flawed human who interacts with other flawed humans. But without studying and appreciating the value of history, there is no institutional memory of past successes and failures from which to gain wisdom. The exercise of wisdom requires knowledge of history. Anyway, that's what I think, but I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, and check out early episodes of the Martial Brain podcast on my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for the Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions, in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast, and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Marshall Brain or about the Rising Phoenix Academy at my website, rpmartialarts.com.